Dana Beal. Dana's presentation was on immune modulation and mechanism of action, but we have had a technical problem with his disc, and his slide presentation is not available. So Dana is at a disadvantage of having to present without a slide presentation. Dana,
you can sit down. You know, I was really afraid. I wanted him to put it on a DVD, and he put it on a CD, so it won't make any difference. Well, a lot of my material was on your presentation. But, and it's also on the poster that I have back at the room, so I could have had the poster here, but I didn't think I needed to bring it. And it's also on the poster that's down at the Harm Reduction Conference. The problem is that, you know, we made a slideshow kind of the last day, and we didn't check it. You know, we just didn't check it. So that's a mistake. Yeah, supposedly. I don't believe it's really empty. I just believe we can't access it. When I presented in Salt Lake City, I had a DVD, and the DVD worked fine. But we had a CD show compared to the others was only like 28 slides, so it would have been great. I could have talked a long time about each slide. Kind of hard to do this without slides. Thank you, RJ. He was kind of irritated. I don't think he did a very good job. Well, RJ is going to get kicked out of the house, and he isn't going to be able to use my internet between midnight and 8 a.m. anymore. Like I said, I have a poster that has this information on it. The poster is currently up down at the slideshow, or down at the... down at the Harm Reduction Conference, but I have a couple props anyway, so I'm going to try to do this. Okay, first, I have to thank Stanley Glick and Ken Alper for the original research. There's a bunch of stuff I would like to say about your thing, but Howard Lotsoff called me at I think 7:15 in the morning when I'd just gone back to sleep, and I really need my sleep in the REM phase, or I'm not very good that day. And so I feel a little bit fuzzy. And I really would have been helped by having slides, you know, because then I could just explain what they meant. About 10 years ago, I published this book, The Ibogaine Story. And in this book, there's a paper in the appendices called Quantum Coherence and Microtubules. And when I published this book and before I published this book, people said, why are you putting this paper in there? We kind of see how it's related, but you can't really prove it's related. And my answer was, well, ibogaine is REM-like, and involves basically kind of very speeded up dreamlike activity because of the stimulant component, and it obviously is working on some form of light-like activity because you see things on ibogaine. And what the people who did this paper, who were Kamarov and Penrose, a couple of neurophysicists, concluded was that the neurons in your brain and the dendrites that are you know, kind of like extensions of the neurons to the neuron next to it, are working on are little tubes of microtubule-associated protein, which, when they're precisely 1 nanometer wide, water confined to a tube 1 nanometer wide spontaneously lases. It takes heat. It takes Brownian motion. It converts it into laser light. And it seemed obvious to me that these processes had to involve something like the microtubules. But I didn't really have much experimental evidence. Recently, a paper has come out on acetylcholine, cognition, and consciousness, which ties it all together very nicely, kind of like a bow, you know, tying up everything with a ribbon. And it's this paper that is what I'm really presenting. But first, I'm going to say a couple things about what the good doctor from Israel said. One of the important things about the 18-methoxycoronuridine is that the same results were obtained without a number of receptor effects that kind of confused the issue. So if you can obtain the same results with fewer receptor effects, Glick and Alper feel that you're showing which receptor effects are really vital and which are superfluous. One of the big receptor effects that they got rid of was the sigma-2. Sigma-2 is not activated in any significant amount by 18-MC. And this is good because this is what makes people have tremor, and it's neurotoxic, and it makes you puke. It gives you motion sickness if you try to move, and it would be wonderful if it was a form of ibogaine that didn't do that. Now, it's a little, you know, it's a little premature to say what 18-MC will actually do in humans because it hasn't actually been given to humans. And it may be that, for instance, sigma-2 affects the insula, which is a recently discovered part of the brain. And when people had an injury in the insula, it was recently discovered, rather, that They got rid of their cigarette addiction when the insula was inactivated. The insula is next to the part of the brain that's affected by sigma 2. That's the balance part, which is over here, and the insula is here. And since the effect is very strong, you might hypothesize that sigma 2 is still doing something even though it's not working in 18MC. Another effect that was not present with 18MC is NMDA antagonism. And he spoke about NMDA antagonism. When people discovered that ibogaine was an NMDA antagonist, they thought, aha, we have it. There have been many aha moments with ibogaine. And it doesn't really turn out to be the explanation. It's a partial explanation, but it's not the explanation. But NMDA antagonism is found to downregulate withdrawal from opiates and supersensitization to stimulants, which is the thing where when you start, you do even a little bit of coke, after having been a coke user, you have a way out of a scale reaction to the coke, and you start binging like crazy on coke, right? And so it was thought, well, this is it, you know, because we knew, you know, it had certain effects on other neurotransmitter systems. But this, you know, say when NIDA was looking at it in 95, this was really new information. And in my book, I talk a lot about it. But that's not present with 18MC. On the other hand, 18MC has never been given in humans. And there's an interesting experimental finding by a guy named Conkay, I think it's around 2001, having to do with messenger glutamate pathways. You have a number of glutamate pathways in the brain, and the messenger 5 pathway, when it was eliminated in knockout mice, these are mice that are bred not to have that pathway, they couldn't be trained to bar press coke. You remember, in the thing we just saw, they press the lever until they die, right? Except these mice were different because they had no glutamate pathway. They didn't remember because glutamate is important for long-term learning, right? And they didn't remember that they were supposed to become addicted, I guess. They were hooked up to a cannula so they could, it was detected that these rats were spiking with dopamine and serotonin, so they should have become addicted, but without the glutamate 5 pathway, they couldn't be trained to bar press the lever. They pushed, you know, got a couple injections of coke, and they went back to eating and having sex like normal rats and didn't become addicts. So it may be that ibogaine, because of the NMDA antagonism, is somehow scrubbing that pathway or deconditioning it. It may be that ibogaine is more effective than 18MC when we get it into humans. But there were three receptor effects that were common to 18MC and ibogaine. And they were serotonergic, the 18MC sought to get rid of excess serotonin effects because these were supposedly hallucinogenic, and I don't know that because you can also get hallucinogenic effects with NMDA stuff. But they got rid of these effects. However, I haven't seen the profile of the metabolite of 18MC. And yes, 18MC has a metabolite like ibogaine. And it is potentially also sequestered in the fat and released and metabolized gradually into a metabolite that hangs around a long time because it keeps, coming out of the fat and going to the bloodstream. The serotonin effect with noribogaine is pretty important because we see people after they do ibogaine. You know, one of the problems with people who are addicted and quit is they're depressed. And the serotonergic effects of noribogaine are very, very powerful. And so people are not depressed. And what happens is that they have this thing called the ibogaine glow, which is people who formerly had a pallor, people who looked, you know, like they were addicted, right? They look sick, are going around and they're in the pink of health. And they have a lot of energy. Of course, the problem with this is that sometime down the road, 45 days later or 4 months later, they crash because they run out of noribogaine. That's why people give boosters now. And, so like everything, the good thing, it wears off. But as I said, you can give boosters.
5 minutes? 5 minutes?
Oh, my God. Was that fast? Okay, well, I'm going to cut to the chase then. The other two really important effects are 3-alpha, 4, well, no, first, kappa opiate, right? Kappa opiate definitely fights withdrawal, and that is, you know, a reason that, you know, you don't have a lot of withdrawal with opiates. And there's this other effect that's really important, and this gets into the GDNF, which is really was what I was going to present on today, was the GDNF. I got more stuff on GDNF than you did. The 3-alpha, 4-beta nicotinic receptor is antagonized by both substances. What does this mean? Acetylcholine turns out to be a really important substance in the brain. If you antagonize the nicotinic receptor, what you're doing is you're blocking the kind of acetylcholine that you use during the day for muscular movement. What this enables you to do is use acetylcholine for the two other things you use it for. Without, just like REM, you get little twitches, but you're not sleepwalking. The other two things that acetylcholine does is apparently acetylcholine is really important for thought. You have 10 times as much acetylcholine, for instance, as you have serotonin in the serotonergic regions. And like plants, which also use acetylcholine, acetylcholine is apparently really important for the regrowth of dendrites. Now, I had a great slide that showed before methamphetamine, lots of dendrites. After methamphetamine, significantly reduced dendrites. And the next slide shows a cell line after GDNF, which is glia cell line-derived neurotropic factor, that these little dopaminergic cells start sprouting again. Now, what's happening here apparently is that your acetylcholine through the muscarinic receptor, which is not blocked, is speeding up the regrowth as modulated by the GDNF, and you're regrowing the ventral tegmental area dopamine neurons in a way that is similar to what happens in REM sleep, except that, of course, with addicts or with people like me who have problems going back to sleep in the morning and getting their REM, the effect is interrupted. People wake up and they never get their REM. So it can take months and months and months to recover. And if we had something that would switch on the GDNF reliably, then you could recover much more quickly. Now, this is extremely important for psychostimulant abuse because we don't really have much for psychostimulant abuse. In fact, the one thing they're using for amphetamines in the U.S. is Wellbutrin. And Wellbutrin antagonizes the 3-alpha-4-beta acetylcholine receptor. Of course, Wellbutrin, I don't think, does anything with GDNF. So it is the it is a combination of effects that's working with ibogaine or with HENMC. And they together, what you do is you regrow the part of the brain that's trashed. It's as if you had a natural mechanism to recover, right? But somehow the brain was kind of like bumbling around and couldn't discover what it was supposed to be doing. In other words, there is an immunologic response to addiction, which is to regrow these neurons. Ibogaine switches that on. Now, I have a hypothesis that there may be other growth factors that are responsible for the effects with hepatitis C, which is just beginning to be studied. And we've seen some really dramatic individual effects with hepatitis C, where people went from hundreds of thousands viral load to less than 10,000 with a single dose of ibogaine. And this is very exciting because it takes months and months of very toxic interferon treatments to achieve these effects. And this could be, you know, a real breakthrough when dealing with the harm reduction movement, which is a little put off by ibogaine because there are two things about the harm reduction movement. One, they're very invested in methadone. And two, they're very invested in needle exchange. So I had somebody tell me yesterday from Holland, well, we couldn't introduce ibogaine because people get it in the street and mix it, and then they would die. Of course, they're not really dying. It's like the guy in France. They're not really dying from the ibogaine. They're dying from doing heroin on top of ibogaine. And I didn't remember to respond until the guy was gone that, well, then in that case, you could never detox anyone. Detoxification leads to a situation where the first time, it's well known, people come out of prison. They go out, do their regular dose of heroin, overdose, and die. So the harm reduction movement is very invested in maintenance, either maintenance on heroin or maintenance on methadone, whereas this is something different. And the one thing they don't have is they don't have a real good treatment for methamphetamine, which has now become a big deal in a lot of places. And they really don't have anything that really works very well for hepatitis C. And in fact, I'm told now that the new synthetic interferon, because they couldn't get enough of the original stuff to make the interferon, doesn't work at all. So I think that these immune effects, both the regrowth of the part of the brain, you see, addicts feel out of sorts for a long time, even after they get rid of the original withdrawal effects, which are actually brief, because they have not really a deficiency of dopamine. They don't have enough receptors to feel the dopamine. And what ibogaine does through, it's really neat, the GDNF sets up a self-reinforcing loop where the GDNF back signals and makes more messenger RNA that makes more GDNF, which makes more messenger RNA. And I'm going to give these things out. This is one slide. And I'm going to give these out to everybody because I didn't have my slideshow, thanks to RJ. This is a glutamate. This is an acetylcholine. Apparently what's happening is that the acetylcholine directly goes into the dendritic shaft and is causing growth. The glutamate has a function of cutting growth off, so it doesn't get so close to the neuron. It goes on to an actin, another kind of little submicroscopic substance that's on the side, and tells it when it's, you know, time to shut off. So I'm really sorry about the lack of the slideshow. You can see all this on my poster, which is down at the conference. And the take-home message of this, Howard, is don't call me at 7:15 in the morning or I won't be able to even think without a slideshow.
Thank you for your presentation, Dana, which was actually quite adequate. Additionally, we'll see that Dana's slide presentation is made available on the web so that you can see it. Moshe, I'd like you to assist me by timing me and making sure that time me to 30 minutes or less.
Okay.
So I don't go over. And if you would take some photographs, that would be appreciative. Let me.
Was this turned off?
More 100% recovery.